Studio 360 is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names to represent you or your business. If you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name and include all the tools and support you need to manage it. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code CULTURESHOCK.
Today in Studio 360...
Burning weed with its roots in hell.
We've come a long way since Reefer Madness.
Did you inhale?
Somebody asked this question. I said, that was the point.
Since marijuana is reaching a mainstream tipping point now, I'll talk to a design firm about how they'd go about marketing it legally.
Can we replace that end-of-day glass of wine with the end-of-day glass of pot?
Oh, have you ever met that funny Reefer man?
And we'll hear from artists and scientists about which is better for creativity, weed or booze.
I'm drinking to stop the noise in my head so I can express what I'm feeling in my heart.
Drink a little drink, smoke a little smoke.
Plus the music of Vijay Iyer, pianist and composer and newly minted MacArthur genius. That and much more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Delta Airlines, offering a USB port at every seat on all long-haul international flights. Delta, keep climbing.
When I get low.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
Oh, I get high.
Going on half a century since young Americans discovered marijuana, its context is finally evolving fast. It isn't just bongs and Bob Marley anymore. It's discreet vaporizers and sampling different varieties at the legal local dispensary. So maybe it's time we ditch the chronic leaf bumper stickers and rebrand marijuana as a grown-up thing. That's later in this hour. But to start the show, if you write books or plays or newspaper articles, the Pulitzer Prize, almost a century old, is the award to win. This week, the Pulitzer Board announced the winner and two runners-up in each category. And while most of the press goes to the press, this year in particular to the Washington Post and the Guardian for all their Edward Snowden-enabled coverage of the NSA, Studio 360 is more interested in the winners and almost winners in the artistic categories. Joining me to talk about them is Rachel Syme, former books editor for NPR and a contributor to The New Yorker, The New York Times, and New York Magazine. Rachel, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So Donna Tartt, she won the fiction prize for her novel Goldfinch. How come? And was it correct?
I think it was correct. Donna Tartt is a beautiful writer and a writer of epic scope. She first came into public consciousness a long time ago with
as a
wunderkind out of Bennington with her novel The Secret History, which I think is just a perfect work of fiction. And I almost feel that the award for the Goldfinch is almost a lifetime achievement or a retrospective award looking
back
all the way.
Even though she's not an old person.
No, she's still very young.
Well, and this is only Goldfinch is only her third novel.
But I think one thing that's notable about it was that it was popular. Often the Pulitzer doesn't go necessarily to the most popular book of the year, but The Goldfinch seemed like the novel of the year last year and even heading into this one.
Yeah, the obscure didn't do so well. I mean, the one of the other finalists in that category was The Sun by Philip Meyer.
Yeah.
Which I read and is a terrific novel, also gigantically long, also sold really well. So they seem to be going in the direction of the non-esoteric.
This year anyway. I'm really glad it went to Donna Tartt, though.
Because?
Well, I think that book is beautiful. Gender solidarity. I was really happy that a lot of the artistic prizes this year went to women. A lot of the journalistic prizes went to men.
Well, in the drama category, the winner and all the finalists are women. Annie Baker won for The Flick. Madeline George was a runner-up for The Curious Case of the Watson Intelligence. And Lisa Crone and Janine Tesori for Fun Home. And there's also this weird incestuous connection between the two of those women grew up together near each other in Western Mass. Two of them are married.
Yeah, it does seem a little inside baseball in that way. But I think that Annie Baker, you know, clear front runner. I would have picked Annie Baker by a mile.
I think
she's incredibly talented.
And you saw the flick as well?
I saw the flick. I've seen actually every play Annie Baker has ever done. I'm a big fan of hers.
And another work that's really long. It's like a 3.5-hour play, right?
Yeah, all about the power of the movies and why the movies on film reel should be preserved as opposed to everything going digital.
And it's somewhat funny, right?
Very funny.
It seems like somehow in theater this year, it's like, whoa, comedy's okay. Whereas in fiction, not so much.
Yeah, I wouldn't say The Goldfinch is a particularly funny book.
No, or The Sun.
No, not definitely not The Sun.
Do you think that women in the literature and letters category did so well that we're making up for past sexism, or it was entirely on merit?
Well, I'd like to say, as a feminist, that it would be on merit completely. But I think that there is a sense of acknowledgement of the fact that in the past it hasn't necessarily been very balanced in terms of gender. I mean, every year these Vita statistics come out about bylines and big publications and awards that are given of this caliber and what the gender breakdown is. And it's just been shown that women haven't historically been winning them. And so I think at this point, anything that goes to women is a win.
This year's Pulitzer Prize winner for music was John Luther Adams for his piece Become Ocean, which we're hearing now. Now, John Luther Adams is not to be confused with the famous composer John Adams, who was also a finalist this year. And John Luther Adams is a longtime environmental activist. This piece is about the melting polar ice caps and climate change. The biography award went to a book about Margaret Fuller, the 19th century revolutionary and feminist. And then there was the Snowden NSA coverage that controversially got a prize. So I guess the cabal running American media really is just a bunch of left-wingers.
Maybe. It's all about climate change and secrets from the NSA and 19th century feminist activists.
Looking at all the winners and finalists, it seems like, as I suggested earlier, Epic seems to be doing well. Is that a Pulitzer thing, or is that just what's happening now in the kind of literary theatrical zeitgeist, do you think?
I think it's really interesting that it is happening in the zeitgeist because you have the two extremes happening in culture. There's this lack of attention span that people seem to have because of the internet.
The 140 character thing.
Yeah, the sort of just you have time to read a tweet and that's all you have during the day. But then when people are turning to books, they're turning to these, you know, 750, 1,000 page tomes and people keep reading them. I mean, the best-selling book the year before last was the Robert Caro's, you know, I think that one was 1,100 pages.
As somebody who writes for magazines and does broadcasting, do you feel as though the Pulitzers need to be updated to accommodate other media?
Absolutely. I think that they could certainly include broadcasting categories. I think there could also be something that acknowledges the internet. One of the things that the internet has brought us is this amazing new age of essayists. And I would love to see a Pulitzer for maybe a first essay collection as well.
Columbia University Pulitzer Prize Committee, you heard Rachel Syme. Do what she says. Rachel Syme is the former books editor of NPR and a contributor to The New Yorker, The New York Times, and New York Magazine. So, listeners, what do you think? In the Pulitzers this year, who was robbed or who unjustly won? Tell us in a comment at studio360.org. A few weeks ago, I proposed a new listener challenge. Come up with collective nouns for groups of modern people. We have a murder of crows and an ostentation of peacocks. But what should we call a group of DJs or a bunch of hipsters? We've been calling listeners to talk about their submissions. And I've got one of those listeners who sent in his submissions on the line. Is this Ken Burns from New Hampshire?
It is. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. So your name sounds familiar. You must be that documentary filmmaker, Ken Burns.
Yeah, I've been known to make a couple documentaries, yes.
Well, thank you truly and sincerely for submitting to our collective nouns challenge. Is this something you regularly do, go on public radio websites and participate?
I've never done it before in my life. I've just loved collective nouns since I was a little boy. My father told me about a murder of crows and an exaltation of larks, and all my life I've sort of thought about them and played with them and loved the stretching of our language poetically, lovingly, thoughtfully. It's like Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky, you know?
Absolutely.
You, as a member of the gabble of NPR hosts, know what I'm talking about.
Gabble? The gabble's a good one.
Yeah, I think a gabble of NPR hosts is appropriate.
One reason I love them is because so many of them seem fictional, but they are real. So us, you, the crowd, creating new fictional ones seems sort of appropriate.
I agree. And I've got four daughters, my bevy of beauties, by the way, that I have spent my life teasing collective nouns about, and they love it too.
Well, I want to have you read your list. You dutifully and obediently did all 10 of the ones we had on offer. So tell the world.
A something of conceptual artists, a harumph of critics, a scratch of DJs, a disdain of hipsters, a borrowing of indie filmmakers, a relief of IT guys, a crescendo of opera goers, a cluster of Trekkies, a possession of venture capitalists, and a contortion of yoga instructors.
Those are excellent, and I want to talk about a few. First of all, I guess you're not exactly or necessarily an indie filmmaker, but explain a borrowing. This is because indie filmmakers tend toward the homage of the previously made?
Well, you know, I felt when I was thinking about it and free associating, which is, I think, a key to collective noun fictionalizing,
yeah.
I just thought of maxing out your parents' credit cards or your own credit cards. And I
Aha.
just thought that this is what we're always doing, even in public broadcasting. We're sort of borrowing on the good faith of our listeners or our watchers, and that seemed to be appropriate, a borrowing of indie filmmakers.
And, of course, indie filmmaker could be a heavy overlap, in, if you made a Venn diagram with hipsters, a disdain of hipsters. Hipsters,
yep.
and their most salient feature is disdaining the unhip?
I think so. I think part of being a hipster is to know that you are part of a small, small group of people, infinitesimally small, and the rest of humanity is something up with which you must put.
Up with which you must put. Nicely said.
Never end a sentence with a preposition.
Yes, I know, and I agree. Now, I think my favorite of yours was the conceptual artist one. Explain that.
Yes. Well, you know, I there's something conceptual artists too often, in my humble opinion, sort of hide behind that concept, and often it's head-scratching for the rest of us. And I thought here, something of a conceptual artist seemed to be exactly, I don't know what, a something of conceptual artist.
It's fantastic, and it's so, in the conceptual arty way, meta, of course.
Yes, of course. It did have a meta component that I thought would appeal to conceptual artists who might then possibly forgive me for being a little bit too critical of their genre.
Yeah. And so, off the top of your head, this was not part of our regular quiz, but what should we call a group of PBS documentary filmmakers, if there is such a thing as a group of them beyond you?
Yeah, well, we're so obstinately independent, it's hard to say. That's a good question. Of documentary filmmakers, it may be difficult. My ancestor, Robert Burns, said, oh, with some power, the gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us. It might be a real documentary filmmaker.
Well done. That's exactly what my producer, independently of you, just suggested into my headphones.
Well, this is the humdrum of the ordinary thinking.
The thoughts I had, just again, as I said this, were what one thought was a grant of documentary filmmakers.
Yes, or a gore, which is another sort of land grant kind of thing. Gore of documentary filmmakers,
yes,
but that
yes.
may be too obscure.
Or I thought a furrow, just because thinking of the earnest furrowed brow thing, maybe? I don't know.
Yes, and it also relates to The Harvest of Shame, one of the seminal documentaries
yes.
About the farm workers. So I like the furrow for its double, if not triple entendre. And of course, for many people who watch documentary films, they have an inscrutability sometimes that may cause them to furrow their brows.
Exactly. It's an interactive furrowing. So I feel free to start using these, by the way.
Yes. No, I think that they become so if we use them a lot, particularly a scratch of DJs or a disdain of hipsters. I think we can do that.
Ken Burns, thank you so much for participating in our listener challenge. It was fun.
It was fun.
You can see all our collective noun submissions so far and add your own at studio360.org. We will reveal our favorites in a few weeks. Ken Burns' latest documentary is The Address, which traces the history and influence of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. You can find out all about that at pbs.org. Coming up in Studio 360,
drink a little drink, smoke a little smoke.
A showdown between alcohol and marijuana. Will either one of them help your creativity?
There have been a bunch of studies showing that alcohol doesn't actually help creativity. What it does is it lowers your judgment so that you think what you're writing is more creative.
The neuroscience of smoking and or drinking. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, maker of the TiVo Romeo, bringing cable TV and streaming apps together in one unified and searchable experience. Available at TiVo.com. And by Hover, helping you get the best domain names along with all the tools and support you need to manage them. When you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name to personalize your blog, business, portfolio, or cat videos. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code CULTURESHOCK.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Marijuana is now legal in two states. Medicinal use is fine in another 20, and the tide of normalization proceeds. Well-known people as various as Miley Cyrus and Andrew Sullivan and Richard Branson have all come out of the closet. The Cheech and Chong jokes, the Snoop Dogg jokes, the Snoop Lion jokes, they're not landing anymore. In the past, Studio 360 has had graphic design firms redesign icons like the gay pride flag and Christmas and the board game Monopoly. So we figured it was time now to ask what a mainstream rebranding of marijuana might look like. We put producer Michelle Siegel on the job.
This is Amy.
I work in children's publishing. I have two kids, 16 and 20, and I'm coming out of the pot closet. Sort of.
Amy is not her real name. We also altered her voice.
I want to come out of the pot closet, but I can't fully yet.
She smokes about once a week.
Basically, every single friend of mine smokes pot. And in fact, my kid's school, there's like a dealer who sort of caters to the parents of the students, which is nice.
For Amy, getting a little high just feels better than kicking back with a glass of wine.
For me, I just find it's just a fun headspace to be in. I'm not really much of a drinker. I love to laugh. So it's that kind of a thing. I don't like to be like super stoned and wasted and immobilized. That's to me is dreaded. But I like to be able to go about my business, hang out with people, or even just get things done and just have everything be just a little bit shinier and happier.
Most of the time, she uses a device called a vaporizer, but she doesn't really like the paraphernalia.
You know, like there's no like West Elm bong, which I would like. Don't you think that would go perfectly on my mantle?
If marijuana is starting to go mainstream, a lot of people like Amy, folks who don't identify as stoners, will want it to look and feel different. Studio 360 wanted a professional design opinion on what that would be like.
I'm Jennifer Kynan, co-founder of OCD.
Bobby Barton, co-founder of OCD, the original champions of design.
OCD has created identity systems for national brands like the WNBA and the Girl Scouts of America. A pretty wholesome lineup,
until now.
My knee-jerk reaction when you called at first was, this might not be great for OCD. It's a really fun project. It doesn't imply that we smoke pot. We don't. I never have. I've been the dorkiest person in the office for the past couple days trying to wrap my mind around this. But the scientific research is actually something that I do believe in.
At their studio in Manhattan, Jennifer Kynan walked me through their design process.
Before we start designing, but after we've gotten the brief, we like to pull together some just market overview, the visual inspiration, some ideas for new opportunities, and then just a little look at the next steps. So that's what we'll look at today.
She started with this list.
Weed, dope, grass, ganja, cannabis, reefer. There, it goes on and on and on and just gets goofier from there all the way down to blueberry yum yum, AK-47, Kansas ditchweed. It's pretty hilarious. We want to know if we're going to help rebrand or reposition marijuana, what are the names that are already out there right now and the current connotations that are carried with them? How, if we're going to reposition that, would we consider renaming?
Next, they identified three audience categories. Wellness freaks.
So let's go to the wellness freaks and deliver to them the new organic. Can we sell it the way you sell a vitamin? You wake up in the morning, you take your fish oil, you take your multivite, and you take your pot.
Lean-in moms.
Being a lean-in mom, you're always looking for the best product. So can we replace that end-of-day glass of wine with the end-of-day glass of pot?
And the third target group, foodies.
Foodies like to eat. Marijuana increases your appetite. So why not incorporate pot into your hors d'oeuvres?
With those audiences in mind, OCD started thinking about graphics.
We'll start testing them out and seeing if a single identity system can address all of these different audiences. Are they one universe of user? Or like chocolate, will it have several different identities? You know, M&M's going mainstream, Toblerone going high-end. Do we need to start differentiating our types of pot for the audiences that will appreciate them?
When marijuana goes as mainstream as M&M's, will it really be as harmless as M&M's? I called an expert, Sherry Emery. She teaches health policy and administration at the University of Illinois.
Right now, I'm agnostic about marijuana and the health effects of marijuana. We just don't know.
What Emery is really concerned about is that big tobacco might move into marijuana sales.
If you have an industry like tobacco that is not value neutral moving into this territory, tobacco industry does predatory pricing. They target their marketing to the most vulnerable elements of the population, like the lower income groups, children, and they produce a known toxic product that has no safe use. That's my concern, is that marijuana may become the new route to save the big tobacco industries.
I asked our designers at OCD to keep that concern in mind. A few weeks later, they came into the studio to show me and Kurt their new brand identity for marijuana. Here's Jennifer Kynan.
Now, instead of renaming marijuana, we want to reposition the experience.
Right.
So the same way that in the 90s we did natural food, then we started to eat organic food, now you can have cannabiotic food. We were excited after coming up with the name because when you Google search it, it doesn't exist. It's not a term in our...
Canna. I get it.
Canna. I get it. Yes. Cannabiotic. So you bring the cannabis into the food.
Uh-huh.
And it is, instead of just another level of eating, it's another level of eating that brings another level of consciousness.
Sounds almost too healthy. But
exactly. Perfect for our wellness freaks and foodies.
Okay. So you're thinking of this as what you're doing. This branding is purely as an edible.
That's how we see it going to into new demographics.
Yeah. Because people don't want to smoke, even, period.
No, smoking's out. Yeah. Smoking's out as a way to consume anything.
Yeah.
The first graphic was a purple symbol. This is how they replaced the pot leaf on all those bumper stickers.
The new symbol is really a simplified version of the marijuana leaf. It's completely abstract. It's seven leaves, different lengths, each leaf. It looks a little bit like a very short, rounded Christmas tree, if you will, or a smushed asterisk, as if it's sitting down on the ground. And it's not green anymore.
Right. It's purple?
It's purple
now.
Why
is it purple?
It's purple now because all of the cues of relaxation.
Purple is a relaxing color?
Well, it's relaxing. I mean, there are some cues to wine, to red wines, and subtle connotations of a purple haze and things like that, that come through. So some connection to what people understand marijuana to be is okay. But at the same time, we can then move it further along so that it starts to represent a different thing.
That makes sense. And it's tasteful and unembarrassing, unlike the marijuana leaf has been even when I was 18.
OCD also came up with slogans that would be part of the Cannabiotics branding campaign.
Conscious untensioning for lean-in moms. There's a picture of a young woman who is presumably the lean-in mom. Conscious untensioning. Did you get that from the recent Gwyneth Paltrow conscious uncoupling idea?
She's quite an inspirational lady, that Gwyneth Paltrow. Bringing marijuana to these demographics is all about consciousness.
Yes.
And that's just in the ether right now. And it's something so applicable to choosing marijuana over alcohol. Uh-huh. Conscious untensioning.
Untensioning? Does untensioning appear? Did you Google it? Have people used that a lot as a word?
No.
Really? A hot new word for 2014 we've gotten already. that makes sense. I can see this.
But with so many edible products, it would be super important to keep them safely away from children.
And I guess that would mean that people at home, like they have liquor closets or liquor cabinets, would have a cannabiotics closet so their four-year-olds don't start eating the cheese whiz full of pot.
Absolutely, yes. It needs
cheese
to be
whiz, by the way. That's a good cannabiotic product, I think.
It needs to be.
OCD addressed this danger with another mark. It's a circle in a harsh shade of lime green, and the graphic is their abstract leaf, now in white, perched above crossed bones.
It is designating the area where you're going to store your cannabiotics and making sure that it's clearly communicated, eat this brownie, not that brownie. So developing a clear marking, playing off of that poison symbol. You know, this isn't for regular consumption. You need to eat this responsibly.
And do you conceive of this as, if it were to come to pass, being an individual proprietary company thing or some kind of trade association mark and system?
I think it would be a trade association. Like here we spoof the Cannabis Farmers of America. So it's really like a Got Milk campaign or drink your orange juice in the morning. It's all about finding that time and place to use the right substance.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's plan on reuniting here in 7 years and see how close to reality we have described, okay?
Fantastic.
I'll take you up on that.
Okay.
We're here.
Thanks, guys. That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can see all the images from the design proposal by OCD, Original Champions of Design, at studio360.org. Our rebranding scheme was produced by Michelle Siegel.
This is your brain.
Remember this.
This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs.
The catchiest piece of agitprop from the heyday of the war on drugs.
Any questions?
Marijuana advocates have always argued that the much more dangerous drug is for sale at your local liquor store and supermarket. But it's hard to imagine American culture without either booze or now pot. From Louis Armstrong, a prolific marijuana smoker, to Ernest Hemingway, a heroic drinker. We asked producer Michael May to look into how America's two favorite drugs affect the creative mind.
Have you ever held a glass of bourbon up to the setting sun?
Jason White is a Nashville-based singer-songwriter and whiskey connoisseur.
You should try that sometime. It makes a lovely amber light. I think it's my favorite color.
White works on his songs in the sober light of day, but the lyrics don't really start flowing until the bourbon does.
I make a point of trying not to drink before the cocktail hour ever. That's just a line I don't like to cross. But most of my productivity occurs after the sun goes down, and I'll sit down on the porch and I'll pour myself a glass of bourbon. That's when the magic seems to happen. And I think it's, you know, a matter of being really loose, relaxed, and being in a place where no one can hear me if I just scream total nonsense at the top of my lungs until some words start to take shape and make sense.
Urban rain been falling on my roof.
Drinking and playing music go back a long time. The first evidence of fermented beverages was found at a 9,000-year-old archaeological site in China, alongside some of the oldest intact musical instruments. Jason White started on both pretty young. He wrote his first drunken song at 15, after guzzling a Colt 45. And later, he formed a hard-drinking band called the Janglers. You know the type.
Our roadie was instructed to have a shot of Jim Beam and a Rolling Rock on top of my amplifier at all times, you know.
But if alcohol is a muse, it's kind of an unruly one.
What we know about what alcohol does to the brain is that it primarily inhibits brain activity. That would sound like maybe not a good thing for creativity, and in a lot of ways that's true.
Harvard professor and neurologist Alice Flaherty wrote a book called The Midnight Disease about writers and writer's block.
When your alcohol level first starts to rise, the first thing that it inhibits is some of the inhibitory systems.
And that's why that first shot of whiskey at sunset feels so good.
People start feeling maybe a little euphoric or excited, and they might be more active for a little while. That's usually as your blood alcohol is rising, and you can't really keep that going.
Jason White hit a wall in the early 90s. His best friend and bandmate committed suicide. His girlfriend of 3 years dumped him. He holed up in a cabin for 6 months with a supply of bourbon and red wine.
It was a terrible, terrible time in my life, and my head was full of tough stuff, tough memories.
Dr. Flaherty says it's not just a cliche that we drink to forget.
Memory and creativity have a very complicated interaction. There are a few studies that show that decreasing your memory, shutting it off, can be helpful.
When I'm in that process and when I'm going through a phase like that, I'm drinking to stop the noise in my head so I can express what I'm feeling in my heart.
The songs White wrote in the cabin were bought by a major label, and now he's got a good career as a songwriter. But he's worried that if he stopped drinking, he'd never be able to write another song. And that might be true.
There have been a bunch of studies showing that alcohol doesn't actually help creativity. What it does is it lowers your judgment so that you think what you're writing is more creative. It reminds me a little of William Stafford, who said that all you have to do to get rid of writer's block is just lower your standards. But, you know, that's the legitimate thing, in that if you're judging your work less harshly, you may actually feel more liberated to produce it.
It's hard to want to get out and just air your dirty laundry in front of a bunch of people, you know?
But here's a funny thing. White's biggest success wasn't written while he was drinking. Years ago, a friend left a marijuana bud on his coffee table. He wasn't a pot smoker, but he popped it in a corncob pipe, lit it up, and in 40 minutes wrote a song called Red Ragtop. It was a huge hit for Tim McGraw.
I was 20 and she was 18. We were just about as wild as we were green in the ways of the world. She picked me up in that red rag top. We were free of the folks, hiding from the cops on a summer night.
Dr. Flaherty says scientists are only beginning to understand how marijuana actually works in the brain.
One of the important aspects of creative attention, it's often hyper-focused in certain ways, and yet you have to be able to pay attention to relevant things that you're not expecting. Marijuana seems to help that focus.
Scientists are studying whether pot helps with divergent thinking, the free associative, idea-generating state that's considered an index for creativity.
There's a study that shows that it helps it. There's another study that says that it doesn't have an effect and maybe even makes it worse.
They're inconclusive partly because it's so hard to study creativity. The experiments might ask you to find a link between a series of words, like cottage, Swiss, and cake. And if you're stoned, then maybe you already know the answer is cheese. Of course, artists have been conducting their own experiments on pot and creativity for generations. Fred Tomaselli is a well-respected painter who's incorporated actual drugs into his collage-like paintings, including marijuana leaves.
So there was this funny conversation that I was having with pot at that point in my life, and I think it did ultimately inform the imagery and the sensibility of the work.
His early pieces are more geometric, minimalist. But as he started coming into his own as an artist in the 80s, he began to explore the synergism between art and drugs in a more intentional way. His work became more ornate and complex. His collages burst with swirling colors and images of nature, birds, insects, the cannabis leaves themselves. He's kind of a late-blooming psychedelic artist.
I think a lot of the psychedelic art was kind of packaged by hippie culture, and then I was just a consumer of it before I even actually took psychedelic drugs or smoked pot. In a lot of respects, it kind of maybe influenced what the experience was supposed to be like.
That raises a question. Is there something about the 60s aesthetic, those intricate patterns, the groove-heavy music, that's actually caused by the effects of pot? Tomaselli thinks it is.
You know, I think this idea of like kind of repetitious, say, mark-making, that's the hallmark of stoners and outsider artists. There's something that marijuana has that allows that kind of activity to come to the forefront, create these rhythms, visual rhythms for the mind.
So how do alcohol and marijuana compare? Alcohol might put you in a creative state for a little while, silencing your inner critic and your bad memories. But pretty quickly, your work is going to deteriorate. Marijuana can help with attention and focus, but it makes some people lose motivation. What if you could boost creative thinking without the side effects and health hazards? Alice Flaherty is working with a brain stimulation treatment that doesn't involve drugs at all. There's just one small drawback.
The kind that I use with my patients involves a surgical implantation of electrodes, and most people aren't that fond of creativity that they would be willing to mess with that.
You can imagine the sci-fi scenarios, but I think it's safe to say that for now, the artistic set will probably stick with their bourbon and bongs. For Studio 360, I'm Michael May.
What about you? Have you ever accomplished anything great, creative, or otherwise as a result of using pot or alcohol? Leave us a comment at studio360.org. Switching now from Studio 420 back to Studio 360, Vijay Iyer, who doesn't just hear music when he's got his headphones on.
When I listen to Thelonious Monk's music, I hear his hands, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I hear actions in the music. I don't hear just sounds.
The jazz composer Vijay Iyer is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Delta Airlines, offering a USB port at every seat on all long-haul international flights. Delta, keep climbing.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. Vijay Iyer, age 42, is one of the great living jazz musicians, although a lot of his music isn't what you'd recognize as jazz. Along with leading a piano trio and playing duets with a saxophonist, Iyer composes chamber music, and he's written a song cycle about the Iraq War. Last year, he was named a MacArthur Genius, and this year, he released his first album on the prestigious label ECM. It's called Mutations, and when he came in, I asked him to start us off with a piano and electronics piece from it called Vuln, Part 2. That was Vijay Iyer performing Voln Part 2 on piano and laptop. Was there a Part 1 that I missed, or did you start off with this?
You know what happened when we were making this album, Mutations? There were two parts to it, and the second part ended up being split off from the first part and put at the end of the record. Uh-huh. So that's basically what happened. That's why this is Part 2, because it sort of starts in the middle. But I kind of like that ambiguity.
Yes.
Where you have to ask, well, where was Part 1?
So on this record, there are three piano pieces, but the heart of it is this piece for strings in 10 sections. I want to play a little bit of one of them called Mutation 3 Canon. That was Vijay Iyer's Mutation 3 Canon. So you wrote that piece almost a decade ago, but this is really the first time you've put this much of what I'd call chamber music on an album, yeah?
Right. So there's never really been a chance to put things like this on albums. But I've been having these works performed for a while. And, you know, I was never trained as a classical pianist, and I would never call myself one. But I also did have 15 years of violin lessons.
Hmm.
So I have actually some kind of...
In the classical repertoire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I played Bach solo partitas, and I played the Mendelssohn concerto, and I played in orchestras, and I did all that stuff. I'm not sure I was awesome at it or anything, but, you know. And I also know what it feels like to be that kind of musician who doesn't really feel empowered to improvise. Even though I am an improviser on piano, I was never an improviser on violin.
Uh-huh.
So that's, for me, an interesting kind of like the Incredible Hulk comes to mind.
Yes,
like
yes.
You have this other side inside of you. That
yes, or Jekyll and Hyde or
yes,
something.
Yes, right, something like that. So I guess I know that sensibility from both sides. And so I wanted to see figure out ways to bring it together.
When you started off in academia, you got your PhD in cognition from UC Berkeley, and then decided, okay, I'm not going to be an academic. I'm not going to be a scientist. I'm going to play jazz. What did that feel like?
I was playing music the entire time.
Sure.
I've been playing music since I was 3. And I didn't really know that I could make it my life until pretty late in the game. You know, basically until I was maybe 23 or 24. That's when I decided, okay, this is my life. And that was after having tried a lot of other things. And then some people helped me create my own doctoral program in music perception and cognition at UC Berkeley.
Did the studying cognition of music change your music?
Well, a lot of the ideas that I kind of was working with and what I learned in those years, they've kind of driven my creative process over the last 15 years since then. Music is an embodied process. It's something we do. We have this constant influx of sensation on multiple channels, and we respond to it by doing things, turning our heads in the direction of a sound or reaching for something. You know, music is us. It came from us. It came from the things that we do with our bodies, including singing and including stomping and clapping and all those other things that we know music is. So it seems like the obvious. It seems like stating the obvious, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. But as so much of academics does.
Yeah. Well, it really, it's, the thing was that there was a field, you know, there is this existing research field, but it sort of hadn't really been thought about in this way before.
Uh-huh.
It's like, it's always like, well, how do we perceive music? As if it lands on us like a flying saucer or something, you know? Not that it is the sound of us.
Right.
I mean, when I listen to Thelonious Monk's music, and that's like the most important music in the world to me, I hear his hands, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I hear actions in the music. I don't hear just sounds in the abstract.
Vijay Iyer, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. A pleasure. My pleasure.
And before you leave, can we hear your actions one more time?
Oh, okay.
And what are you going to play?
I think I'll play the – there's a solo piano piece that opens the album, Mutations, and it's something that was on my first album in 1995. So I wrote it 20 years ago when I was young and foolish, and it's called Spellbound and Sacrosanct, Cowrie Shells and the Shimmering Sea.
Great. Vijay Iyer's latest album, Mutations, is out now. You can hear both of the songs he played here in full at studio360.org. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you so much for listening. By the way, we're posting great stuff all week long on Facebook. And at studio360.org, we want you to keep posting collective nouns for modern people. We've had great suggestions so far, including a suffering of hipsters and an enterprise of Trekkies. Keep them coming. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
This is your brain. This is Studio 360. This is your brain on Studio 360.
That actually looks pretty tasty.
Any questions?
Yeah, could I get that with some bacon and hash browns?
PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, delivering cable TV and internet TV together in one searchable and unified viewing experience. Available at TiVo.com.
Next time in Studio 360, Lois Lowry's The Giver opened a new world of dystopian fiction to kids. and makes some adults very uncomfortable.
They feel the book is too dark and sinister and frightening, and I sympathize with that.
Lois Lowry, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.